Hello, everyone. It's time to play a game. You all pretended to cure me, but what I have planned for each of you is very real.
When the war started, they protected me. Took better care of me than humans would have.
They're not people, Maya. It's just programming.
10 years ago today, the artificial intelligence created to protect us detonated a nuclear warhead in Los Angeles. This is a fight for our very existence.
Sergeant Taylor, we are this close to winning the war. But the AI are developing a super weapon. Retrieve it. Or they win.
Yeah, it's just a kit.
Are you going to heaven?
No. You gotta be a good person to go to heaven.
So, we're the same. We can't go to heaven because you're not good. And I'm not a person.
Do you have any idea what the thing is?
She looks like a little girl now, but she's growing. Whoever has that kid wins the war.
Hello, and welcome to the Movie Robcast. I'm your host, Rob Wallace, and as always, it's a true delight to be joined by my co-host, Mr. Rob Daniel.
And as always, it is a true delight to be here.
And today, we're going to be catching up on a variety of films, including Saw X, the newly released 10th installment of the Saw franchise, Rise of the Foot Soldier Vengeance, the latest installment in the Rise of the Foot Soldier franchise. We're also going to be talking about A Haunting in Venice, the latest installment in Kenneth Branagh's Poirot franchise, and The Creator, a new original high-concept sci-fi movie from Gareth Edwards.
Yeah, so we couldn't get the four franchise films in one. Damn.
Yeah, I can't imagine not to jump ahead that the creator is necessarily going to spawn a franchise.
I can't imagine it either. What should we start off with?
Should we start with Saw X, which you have seen and I have not?
Yes, indeed. So Saw X, so Saw 10, which means that Jigsaw, the 2017 spin-off, reboot, and Spiral, the 2021 spin-off, because that was from the Book of Saw, now kind of all part of the same series, so this could be called Saw 10. But is it Saw 10, Rob? Is it Saw 10? Because Tobin Bell is back as Jigsaw, the terminally ill serial killer.
Terminally ill? He's dead!
I know. That's the thing.
So it's very Monty Python.
That's right.
Terminally ill?
Well, I was going to say that, but you beat me to it. He is terminally ill. He is a terminally ill serial killer who has a penchant for teaching people moral lessons by putting them into fiendish traps where they have to do something terrible to themselves in order not to die. And they learn a lesson through that, apparently. Sometimes it works more as a concept than not. But, hang on a sec, didn't Jigsaw die at the end of the original run of Saw? And he was certainly dead in Jigsaw, because that was set 10 years after his death. So why is he back? Well, he's back because this is called Saw 10, but it's actually Saw 1.5, because it takes place between the first Saw and the second Saw. And really, if you are not a Saw fan, you will have a Saw head trying to work out a lot of where this fits, if you could be bothered to do that.
The continuity of the Saw films is in itself like a Saw trap. It's John Doe's diary from Seven. This is so tangled and so labyrinthine and so...
That's right, it is. You've actually taken a word out of my mouth there, labyrinthine. This is the first series, I think, that could have conceivably and justifiably had a previously on at the beginning, like you get at the beginning of series.
It's so weird you say that, because I have a very similar comment, strange enough, about Rise of the Foot Soldier Vengeance.
Oh, brilliant. Because the Saw franchise was incredibly popular. From 2004 to 2010, there was a Saw film every single year. And they would sometimes, you would get a character pop up in Saw 5 that you hadn't seen since Saw 2. And it was a big reveal that they were still alive. And it's like, well,
who the fuck is this? Yeah.
struggling to remember. Unless you were buying these on DVD and watching them again and again, it was hard to place exactly the storyline and where it was all fitting in. This just takes all of the plays from that original playbook. There is nothing here to put a timeline on, other than the fact that all the tech looks a bit old and Jigsaw, played by Tobin Bell, is still alive. Alan Jones, the horror guru, one of the directors of Fright Fest, he gave an intro to the film because it wasn't press screening, although there were press there. It was this big event screening at the Hamiard Hotel off of Piccadilly. It was very, very well done. There was this big drinks reception thing, and it was full of soreheads, full of just real fans. And it was actually quite good fun watching it with them because they were applauding and whooping when all the grand guignol was splattering about on screen.
Please tell me when they shut the doors on you and everything went dark that Billy suddenly appeared on the screen, Billy the puppet, and said, do you want to play a game? Because that would have been such an amazing...
That didn't happen. That would have been great. They did have a Billy the puppet on the stage that you could have your picture taken with. It was just kind of sitting on the edge of the stage. But it's funny you say that, because when the doors did close and all the lights went down, someone did say, do you want to play a game? And that was quite funny. At one point, actually, all the lights went up again about halfway through the film, and then went down, and then went up, and then went down. And it was like, I think that the person who was doing it didn't quite realise what switch they were doing. But anyway, so all of that was the environment that I saw 10 in. And it's like, okay, so there's nothing here to place it. So Alan Jones had to say it's actually Saw 1.5. It comes between 1 and 2. And it's good. Saw has two really good films in its franchise. Saw 1, which I think is still a great horror film. It's a spin-off of 7, or like a rip-off of 7. There's enough in there, and it has some amazing twists in it, and twists that still work now. It also introduced the world to that amazing score theme, which is just a really good piece of horror music. Saw 6, in which Jigsaw takes on the HMOs, the American Health Authorities, who are just there basically to not pay people insurance when they're terminally ill. That's really good as well. And it seemed to be turning the series into a different direction, because it was in, I think, about 2007-8 that one came out, or maybe 2009. And it's like, this is great because, yeah, we all hate the HMOs. Next time we can go after the bankers, who at that time had just brought the entire world economy to its knees. But that didn't happen. It was just that kind of one-off. And it's like, oh, that seemed to be like quite a good vein of social commentary that you could tap into there. So Saw 1 and Saw 6 are really, I think, really good. Saw 10 is probably the third best film in the franchise. The story is interesting. It kind of leans into Saw 6 a little bit. So basically, John has just found out he's got months to live because of his cancer. He discovers there's a radical treatment that is down in Mexico because it's not FDA approved. So he goes down for this experimental surgery that seems to be a miracle cure for his cancer. It's very expensive. He goes down, he has the surgery, he takes all these drug cocktails. It seems as if it's worked. He swiftly discovers it's all a scam, and this doctor, Dr. Peterson, played by, I'm going to completely mangle her name here, I think she's Norwegian, Synnøve Macady-Lund, is basically just a scam artist, and she's targeting wealthy terminally ill people, and she's doing these bogus surgeries on them, and then she's taking their money and running away. So she and her cohorts haven't reckoned with Jigsaw. He finds them, he captures them, he gets them together, and he makes them play the games to learn a lesson. Now, there are certain people returning. So Shawnee Smith, who plays Amanda, who is Jigsaw's acolyte, who I actually mistook for the Julie Benz character from Saw 5, and I thought I was watching her. She's in it again, and a lot of fans just whooped and cheered when she appeared on screen. But the rest of the cast are new, really. There's a couple other people that I won't spoil, but anyway. The director, Kevin Grutert, who was the editor on Saw for a long time, and he edits this one as well. He also did Saw 6 and 7. He's back. It's fine. It runs for 2 hours, but it's not boring. Because the opening half hour, you're supposed to think all this is actually going to be a miracle cure, even though you know that he still dies. But the trailer gives away it's a complete scam. So you're kind of ahead of the characters. But even that, though, is really well done, because Tobin Bell gives a really good performance as someone who is facing his own mortality. And Tobin Bell has that great face. He actually has a very, very kind face and very kind eyes, but he can just turn it sub-zero on a dime, and it's really good fun to watch him do that. So the opening half hour is really strong, and then it gets into the usual Saw business, and the special effects are good, and it was good watching it with a crowd who were cheering and whooping. There is a slightly off element to this in terms of, so the Dr. Peterson character is this Norwegian woman, but all of her acolytes are Mexican, and two of them are real outcasts. So one's a drug addict and one's a sex worker who've been roped into this scheme. And watching them be punished by this wealthy white man, just, it does leave a bit of a bad taste. It's like, this seems a bit kind of retrograde. It seems a bit, to be honest, 1980s, in which South American brown people were often just the baddies. They couldn't be trusted. This is a weird film in terms of, it makes them quite sympathetic, particularly one of the characters, called Gabriella, played by, I think, Renata Vaca. Yeah. So actually watching her be tortured is like, well, this isn't fun because she's a desperate drug addict. So there's a weird kind of queasiness to the film, I'd say more than in other Saw films, but maybe I just can't remember them well enough. Particularly as it completely positions the John Kramer character Jigsaw, the Tobin Bell character, as the hero. He is, I'd say, more the hero in this film than he's been for a long time. If you like Saw, I would recommend it. You'll probably have a good time. If you don't like Saw, if you don't like incredibly graphic horror, then I would say don't watch this. So yeah, so moving on from one thing that is incredibly graphic and horrible to something that I'm sure is just all sweetness and light, how was the latest Rise of the Foot Soldier film?
Remarkably good.
Because that's not always the case, and to be honest, pretty much that's never the case.
I mean, it's got Craig Fairbrass returning as Pat Tate, who's a fictionalized version of a real-life hoodlum who was killed, whose death is the climax of the original Rise of the Foot Soldier film. And like with Saw X, all the films since then, apart from two, all the films from three onwards have been prequels, so that you can still have Craig Fairbrass as Pat Tate. And he's definitely making the most of his prequel afterlife. Like, him and John Kramer should compare notes.
Yes.
Because in the Saw films, whenever they have a flashback to the stuff John Kramer was up to during the events of a previous film, you're like, my God, he's dying, but he's so busy. He's got like multiple Saw gauntlets going in like parallel. Like, my God, that this man's executive functioning, his use of time is amazing.
Well, that's the thing actually, yeah, that I didn't say about Saw X is that it's like, he creates this entire room, this haunted house of booby traps, apparently in 24 hours. I mean, the timeline of the film is very weird. It's like, how could he possibly have got all this done in 24 hours when he's a dying man with one helper? So, I mean, he would have had to order parts in. Anyway, sorry, back to you.
And so, yeah, Pat Tate, whose characterization changes drastically between the different films, depending on what the that particular story needs him to be, in this is probably the cuddliest that we've seen him. You know, there's a failed bank robbery and he hurls a metal bank case at the head of his accomplice, but then immediately apologizes for it, like, sincerely.
Yeah, that's one of the weird things about Rise of the Foot Soldier. And I saw that Terry Stone, is it, who plays Tony Tucker, who was Pat Tate's accomplice in all of their crimes, is not in this one. And I think that might be the first time that he's not in it. So the Rise of the Foot Soldier series, of course, is about all the people that got killed in the Essex Boys murders. Murders that happened at Christmas in 1995. And it's just become a subgenre of British cinema, the Essex Boys murders. There are so many of these films now. And there's this weird hold that the Essex Boys murders has over our imaginations. Because while they were solved, the people who were charged with the murders have, surprise, surprise, always said they were innocent. And there's all these conspiracy theories around, well, actually, who did do the killings? And Craig Fairbrass, as you said, has made quite a good career in terms of the prequels in just playing Pat Tate, who was scum. But from film to film, dependent on whose perspective the film is being told from, he's either quite cuddly and lovable, he's like a lovable rogue, or he's a complete fucking psycho. It's a fascinating series, Rise of the Foot Soldier. We might have to do an episode on it at some point. But back to you about this one. So what is this one about then? Is it purely fictionalised, I presume? Is it?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Essentially, his mate, his accomplice, who... it took me longer than it should have done, given I'd actually watched all the previous films over the course of the previous week, to go, oh no, that is actually somebody we've seen in the previous films. They're just a bit older, because these films have been going on for like 16 years.
Is that the Jamie Foreman character?
No, it's not. It's the it's played by Josh Myers, a guy called Kenny. And he's like, oh yeah, no, you are in the other films. You are not a new character.
Oh yes, indeed. Sorry, I'm just looking at the IMDb. I recognise the actor, yeah.
But yeah, like, Pat's pretty much sober in this. There aren't any innocent bystanders falling victim to, like, drug-fueled rages.
There's no one getting their face sliced up with a pizza slicer.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, it's largely guilt-free. Essentially, yeah, his mate gets murdered and the police aren't going to do anything about it, and he's got to go after the ones responsible. So it's kind of committing to that vengeance, as the title Rise of the Foot Soldier Vengeance suggests. It's just his journey of revenge. Returning actors, yeah, it's got Jamie Foreman, Emily Wise, but it does have that thing, as you were saying, where occasionally I could, even having watched them all very recently, I could have used a previously on, because it's like presenting a big twist of, oh my god, they're involved, and it's like, I vaguely remember who that is.
The cast for this one looks pretty good. You've got Tara Fitzgerald,
who's great. Tara Fitzgerald isn't in it a lot, but she steals every scene she's in. She's so she's giving such an understated performance compared to everyone else.
And who does she play?
Actually, her character is a bit of a spoiler if I say who she is.
Is she on the good side? Is she on the bad side?
She's on the good side.
Right, okay. And you got Jeff Bell there as well, and Phil Davis. Yeah, it's not a bad cast for a Rise of the Foot Soldier film.
Phil Davis, who's quite a crime boss, who you mostly see kind of like, you know, lounging around in a gown with his Mephistophelian beard.
Right.
You've also got this new character called Billy the Kid, who's a boxer, but he's also got an alter ego. I won't spoil that here, but the film ends up feeling weirdly progressive.
Can you say in what way?
Well, like, for example, like, there's a scene where this guy goes to a drag show. Kenny goes to a drag show and he sits down and he sees somebody, like, drinking a pink cocktail. You know, when the serving staff goes up, what do you want? He's like, oh, I'll have that. It's, like, weirdly not reactionary. No, sorry, it is entirely reactionary, given it's a guy responding to a murder and doing some more murders. But politically, it's almost like they've gone, there's a strong vein of, like, I don't know, fascism? Or something, you know, so essentially, you can imagine that the audience of the Rise of the Foot Soldier films might skew politically to the right.
But these films are reactionary. They are a glamorization of gangster Essex boys culture. It's weird because it's like, I think in one of them, and it might be part three, the Pat Tate story, there's a point when Tony Tucker and Tate go round to someone's flat, but it turns out that the person's not there anymore, and there's a homosexual couple living there, and the homosexual couple come onto them, and Tate and Tucker...
Well, the homosexual couple initially think, like, is this a hate crime?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And then when it turns out that it's not a hate crime, they then start to flirt with them, don't they? And Tate and Tucker then act comically horrified by this and run out, when in reality they would have beaten the two homosexual people to a pulp because they were scum. So there is a disingenuous air to these movies in terms of presenting them as sometimes lovable rogues.
I mean, there is a supporting character in this who, again, I can't remember whether or not they're returning, but is somebody who Pat Tate has really wronged in the past, and that's never really commented on. It's just like, here's a guy that Pat Tate previously really fucked up, but that's okay.
Right. So why is it good then?
It's surprisingly tight, and it's really well judged in terms of its character beats and its action beats. Moving the action to central London, it's impressive how much mileage it gets out of it, because, you know, it's like, this is actually shot in Soho. Oh, that is the Windmill Theatre. Although it's less convincing when they have to shoot a lot of it in soft focus to not give away the fact this isn't in the mid-90s anymore.
Yeah.
It's like,
brilliant.
However much you shoot that in soft focus, that's clearly an American candy shop.
Yes, indeed.
It's a fucking Pret. Like, exactly. It's like...
Well, there was Pret in the mid-90s because I discovered Pret in the mid-90s and thought, ooh, what a fancy sandwich shop this is.
Yeah, this version of Pat Tate would let you get away with saying that.
Right, yeah, indeed. Brilliant. And it's long as well, isn't it? So it's another one that's quite long because it comes in at just under 2 hours.
Yeah, and I was expecting much with the Saw films previously, 90 minutes and out. But this, it gets a bit, weird to say, it gets a bit convoluted towards the end because it has quite a lot of characters you have to kind of, and subplots you're kind of having to kind of keep track of. It's like, come on guys, this isn't The Raid 2. But it's entertaining. As I said, largely guilt-free and strangely progressive.
So what was the audience like?
Sparse.
Oh, was it? Right, because for Rise of the Foot Soldier film, I think they've tended to be, apart from the first one, I could be completely wrong on this, but I think they've tended to be pretty much straight to rental or a day and date with rental. But this one's had a proper cinema release before rental. I think it goes to rental in October. So it's had about 2 or 3 weeks of just being a cinema movie. Then again, it hasn't played at a lot of places because I did look to see if it was around anywhere that I could get to pretty easily and it wasn't. I thought, well, I am going to watch this at some point because I've watched them all. It seems to be playing in London only, the cinema. So there weren't many people there then?
There was a handful of people there. There were more people in there than when I went to see The Creator last night.
Oh, right, okay. Okay, well, I will watch Rise of the Foot Soldier Vengeance. So it's just gone completely into fantasy Death Wish land now then.
Yeah, I think they're leaning more into the... They're going to use it as a vehicle for more genre-based filmmaking.
Well, shall we move on to A Haunting in Venice?
Ooh, you shall.
Well, let me give the IMDb synopsis for this one. In post-World War II Venice, Poirot, now retired and living on his own in exile, reluctantly attends a séance. But when one of the guests is murdered, it is up to the former detective to once again uncover the killer. Yes. This is the, it has to be said, very, very quickly delivered after Death on the Nile, which was, I think, last year. So this is the third installment of the Kenneth Branagh Poirot extended universe. And this one stars Michelle Yeoh as the medium who is conducting the séance. It stars Kelly Reilly as a grieving mother who believes that the spirit of her daughter still haunts this massive Venetian house that she lives in. Who else is in the film, Rob?
There's Jamie Dornan as a traumatised doctor, Jude Hill, who plays the doctor's child, and actually that's a Belfast reunion, both with Kenneth Branagh and between Dornan and Hill, because they played father and son in Belfast.
There's also Tina Fey as an author who has made a fortune from writing books that were loosely based on the Poirot adventures.
She plays Ariadne Oliver.
You know more about this than I do, so who is she?
Ariadne Oliver is... I'm trying to think who played her previously. But yeah, essentially, she's Agatha Christie's kind of self-insert into the stories, because she's a famous mystery writer in the world of Poirot who has created a character very similar, clearly based on Poirot. And they're kind of, I don't know, frenemies?
Well, I think he's slightly irked by the fact that a lot of people think that he was inspired by her books, in this film at least. And that he's trying to become the character from her books. Well, of course, it's the other way around. Yeah, they have a friendship that is slightly spiky. And this whole film takes place over one night. And there seems to be a supernatural element to it. And of course, the thing about the Agatha Christie books in general is that they are not supernatural. There is always a rational explanation to this. But this one kind of rides the uncanny between, is it rational or is there a supernatural element to this? That, I think, is the only time that she did that sort of thing, or am I wrong on that?
I think it is, but this is a very loose adaptation of the story on which it's ostensibly based, which is Halloween Party.
Yes. Yes, I thought it might be because, well, all of her books were based between the wars, weren't they? They were after World War I, but before World War II. This one has been shifted to 1947, so we're just after World War II.
Also, the actual original story is not set in Venice.
Right, okay. Wow, okay.
I think it's because in order to justify like a cinematic adaptation, you kind of need the set piece. You need the train from Murder in the Orient Express. You need the steamer from Death on the Nile. And most of Agatha Christie's stories are set in old English country houses.
Right, yeah.
If, for example, they could very well have done Evil Under the Sun as the next story to adapt. But I think the issue there is that Glass Onion, the Rian Johnson Knives Out sequel, basically did that already. Knives Out, the original, was set in essentially a country mansion. And so it's very difficult, I think, to return to doing the original kind of not meta detective story in those environs because the audiences are primed to expect something different now. You know, they'd almost be a bit disappointed if they went, oh, it's just a standard detective story.
Yes, if it was being played completely straight, then they might just be waiting for the giggles to come or something. Not that there isn't a nice line of humour in all of the Branagh Poirot films, which is one of the things I really like about them. But yeah, I think you're right. It's also, I think, a very, very good idea to shift this to Venice because you have the whole thing, cinematic thing of Don't Look Now. I think they film on a bridge that we saw earlier this year in Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning. There seems to be the bridge that there's that duel on.
Oh, quite possibly.
I think it was also a bridge from Don't Look Now. But Don't Look Now, of course, is the famous Venice on film story, and it happens to be a horror film. This one, I have to admit, and I'll give the case for, because I think you're going to give the case against. This was my favourite of the Branagh Poirot films so far. I had a great time watching this. I cannot understand why it's getting so many bad reviews that are calling it dull or inert. I thought this was a real treat to watch for a couple of reasons. One, it was filmed on location, and while I enjoyed Death on the Nile, heavens, was that a film that I don't think ever left the studio. There was almost no location work in that film, and it looked it. It had that weird, smeary, pastel look of CGI, And while it was good fun, I then watched the Peter Ustinov version afterwards that was shot on the Nile, and there is just something about shooting on a location that really brings the world to life a lot more. So this one looked absolutely gorgeous, and you could see that the canals were real, you could see that the water was real. There's a point when Michelle Yeoh and her two staff members, who are brother and sister, are arriving for the seance, and they arrive by canal boat, and they're dressed up in masks, all looking very Eyes Wide Shut, to be honest. But just that sequence of them arriving, I thought, was absolutely gorgeous. And I love the use of wide-angle lenses in this to bend and warp reality. It actually reminded me of a film called The Legend of Hell House that was shot in the early 70s. That's also a wonderfully imaginatively visual film. And that is a proper supernatural film. There's no doubt that there's something supernatural happening there, whereas there is doubt in this one. The other reason I liked it was because I think shifting it to after World War II just gave the film this real air of melancholy. All of the suspects are really quite broken in this, and Poirot is kind of disillusioned and is in exile. And there are different reasons given for that. And it's not really said that World War II is one of them, but you get the sense that he has seen something utterly illogical happen and just revealed the worst of people. And for him, it's all about, well, I understand motives, but here the motives were just so insane that I think that kind of seems to have broken his spirit as well. But of course, that's at the start of the film. Every character has an arc. Where do we think it's going to be at the end of the film? I also enjoyed just the detective work of it. I liked the way that he was moving around. I liked the characters. I thought that there was a lot of good stuff going on. Even though I have to admit, I did guess the killer. It wasn't like in Death on the Nile when you see something and it immediately just kind of gets your suspicions raised. I don't think that I'm seeing everything here, so therefore my mind is now working on this. With this one, I didn't guess motivation really, but it's like it was the only one that made emotional sense.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's the only one that would provide a narrative arc.
Yeah, it's the only one that would be satisfying ultimately. And there were a couple of other suspects earlier on in the first half of the film, but I thought ultimately, no, I think for it to be satisfying for the audience, I think it has to be this person, and it turns out it was. Then, but there were some twists afterwards that seemed to be original to this particular film. I'm not sure that they were in the book, but we're not going to go into spoilers, so I'll leave that for the audience to watch, and then they can do their own research afterwards. So I did guess the killer. Okay, that's why it was done. But there were some reveals afterwards that I thought also worked quite nicely as well. So that's why I really, really like this one. And it's the first one of the Branagh Poirots that I'm going to watch again. Because Murder on the Orient Express and Death on the Nile, I both liked. But this one, I think there is something to get from going back to this one. So that's the case four. But I don't think you were quite as taken with it as I was.
No, I think for me, it just didn't quite hold together. There were elements that I liked. I think, you know, the kind of faded grandeur of the palazzo, I'm contrasting that to like the glamour of the Orient Express. But I think it's partly the supernatural element. I liked what they did with it on screen, but as you say, because you know there's going to be a rational basis behind it, for me that's what led me to immediately figuring out who the killer was, and then kind of piecing together the motivation afterwards, because it's like, okay, well, it has to be them because it has to be this. Either that or the Branagh Poirot is going to go like, full, no, ghosts are real. Let's talk to some ghosts. Probably the thing I like most about the Branagh Poirot films is that they've got this character through line, or like thematic through line, of embattled faith. The fact that, you know, Poirot is a Catholic, and how he deals with certain events, and this being the aftermath of the war. I think because Branagh ultimately wants to do the final Poirot story, Curtain, the payoff to that, that could potentially be, if he gets to make it, an amazing payoff to the arc of the character.
Which we can't reveal until we do that episode.
Yeah, exactly. Until that film is made and released and we get to see it.
That's right, yeah. But again, I did like, in terms of the faded grandeur, I think that just all tied into a world that was sad. This is actually quite a sad movie. And again, the motivation, although it does make sense, I think there is a certain element there of madness that is, I'd say, taps more into madness and into gothic madness than the previous two films. I thought this was a very, very good example of gothic as well. Yeah, without going into spoilers, those were the reasons that I had a really good time with it. And also the cast were great. I mean, I do like watching Branagh play Poirot. And it was nice to see him reunited with a little lad from Belfast as well, of course. Jude Hill, who he didn't share any screen time with in Belfast because Jude Hill was playing him as a boy. So it was nice to see them together. And Kelly Reilly, it's always great to see her. I haven't seen her in a film for a while, actually. And Michelle Yeoh, of course. Just love Michelle Yeoh. So it was great when she cropped up.
Talking of Belfast, I found that this film also had... It might just be an issue for me. That was creepy. I was looking at my laptop screen and I'm facing towards a door and I'm convinced for a second I saw a figure in the door, and then when I looked up, they weren't there. So that's just thrown me.
Were you watching, have your IMDb on and you've got the trailer on? Because I've got the trailer on and loop.
Literally not at all. Literally, my brain just told me that there was a figure in the door and I looked up and the figure wasn't there. And wow. There shouldn't be a figure in the door because there shouldn't be anyone else in the flat.
Well, I think that this film has got under your skin in more ways than you realise.
If there is someone else in the flat, you can just please leave now and we just don't need to talk about it. Yeah, see, there was... it was just the fact that the sense of Branagh pulling out a lot of directorial tricks in trying to maintain visual interest. But the same issue that I had with Belfast is that it doesn't always quite cut together. I mean, the editor of this, Lucy Donaldson, definitely earned a paycheck. And at some points it works and at some points it doesn't work. But when it doesn't work, it's really distracting.
I agree with that with Belfast, which in some ways seems like a first film from a first-time director who's only been making shorts up to that point.
Yeah, it's like a student filmmaker film.
Yeah, I agree with that with Belfast. With this, I thought that the visual look of the film was very, very consistent and seemed very well planned and storyboarded in that way that, again, The Legend of Hell House, which I think was 1973. And let me just look up the director of that. And it's a good movie. It's kind of a spin on the Haunting of Hill House tale. It sometimes crops up on Talking Pictures. John Howe, who did some other quite interesting films. There was this weird point when I saw The Legend of Hell House, and then I just couldn't stop watching John Howe films. Biggles was another one, because he did that too.
They've only invented a bloody sound weapon.
And he did.
Sorry, do we need to...
What was the other ones that he did? Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, he did that one as well. And Twins of Evil. Eyewitness. It was this weird thing where within about 2 weeks I'd watched 4 John Howe films without actually really having heard of him before. And it was like, my God, he did all these great films. But The Legend of Hell House, yeah, has a very, very good visual look to it. And I don't think it's about maintaining visual interest. I think it's about creating a world in which, for the first time, this character, who is all about rationality, the world might be turning against him and what he believes to be the laws of physics might be challenged. And that, I thought, was a good justification for using those wonderful close-up overhead shots that are framed off-kilter as well, or those wide angles. Yeah, so that will work for me.
Well, different strokes for different folks.
No, you're wrong, and I want you to admit it.
That's ultimately the wrap-up to any discussion, any critical discussion of anything. Well, let's agree to disagree. And it's like, end of podcast. End of critical discussion.
No, don't make me get my Pat Tate out. You're going to say that was a quite well-realised example of the uncanny. Or I'm going to come round there and give you a belting.
You slag.
You Muppet slag. What a weird conceptual thing you've just stumbled into.
Yeah, you know what? If Branagh wants to do a Poirot-Pat Tate crossover, a Poirot-Foot Soldier crossover, they'll figure out, you can figure out how it can simultaneously exist in, like, the 1950s and the 1990s. Like, maybe Pat Tate goes through some sort of time portal, like a Goodnight Sweetheart thing.
It's only a matter of time before they do that. Okay, then, well, to finish off, shall we move on to The Creator? Which is the big release of this week and is the new film from Gareth Edwards, who did Rogue One and Godzilla back in 2014. And he also did Monsters, which was his first movie. And this one is another sci-fi action epic. Looks quite similar to Rogue One when you watch the trailer. But what is the plot synopsis for this one?
Against the backdrop of a war between humans and robots with artificial intelligence, a former soldier finds the secret weapon, a robot in the form of a young child. I mean, also, I don't think that's technically right, because aren't the robots that look like people referred to as synths in this film?
Simulants.
Simulants, sorry, as in being distinct from robots.
Yeah, but Yeah, that's fine. I think that's fine. It's but they're kind of robots in the way that the Westworld robots are robots, or AI from the Steven Spielberg film AI. They are radically advanced versions of robots, because the film opens up with a faux archive footage of the progression of AI and these huge leaps and bounds that robotics is taken on, to the point where you can actually get robots that look like real people.
But it's amazing that that footage can already feel dated, because at no point does it reference ChatGPT.
That's right. Right, in some ways, this has come out at just the right time. In other ways, it's going to look very, very dated pretty much immediately, because, yeah, there's no mention of ChatGPT. This is the second film in a few years to be a sci-fi action epic starring John David Washington. Tenet was the previous version, was the previous film, of course. Here he plays Joshua, who is kind of one-time army special forces, is now disillusioned, forced to go on this mission to find the weapon, finds that the weapon is this young girl called Alfie, played by Madeline Una Voiles. And he's completely heartbroken because he's lost his wife, Gemma Chan, who was in Humans, wasn't she? She was in Humans.
She was.
He's completely heartbroken by that, but he's forced to go on this mission because if this weapon, Alfie, is used against the big resource that the humans have, which is this huge kind of mobile space station, really, called Nomad, that can find the AI bases and blow them up.
And it looks like one of the blades from Halo. It looks like the energy sword from Halo.
Oh, okay, right. Yes, and he goes on this mission with Allison Janney, who is Colonel Howell. She has her own reasons for hating the AI robots. And we have Ken Watanabe, who was in Godzilla. He is one of the AI soldiers who was once very, very close to Joshua. And interestingly, the West are very, very anti-AI because of a nuclear explosion that happened in LA that was blamed on the robots trying to sabotage humanity. The East are very, very pro-AI and are living in harmony with these simulants. So the war is between the West and the East. That's a neat way to break down the history of robotics. So the West, it's always been seen as a threat. So you've had Westworld, and you've had things like, well, Alien. The traitor amongst the crew in Alien turns out to be a robot. And there's a whole tradition of robots are not to be trusted. In the East, particularly in Japan, robotics is seen as a way that can make life better. So there's always been this, I think, warmer feeling to robotics in the East, specifically Japan, than there has in the West. So that was quite a nice way to break it down. What did you think of this? I'm very interested to see what you thought of this.
Sorry to be a negative Nelly, two films on the trot. I didn't particularly enjoy it.
I'm going to be a negative Nelly as well. Oh my God. This film is fascinating in how it doesn't work. Because I really, really like Gareth Edwards. And I know that Rogue One was heavily reshot and changed, but there was, you could still get that kind of feeling from that, that he was behind the camera for a lot of the movie, because it seemed very similar in terms of its grand scale to Godzilla, which was a film that he had complete control over and I think is a really underrated film. That 2014 Godzilla, I think, is great. This one is a triumph of design. The world that they present is astonishing to look at. All the detail, you get a sense this is a real lived-in world, and you get the sense this is what the future's going to look like. And I just loved just looking at it. Just some of the visuals were astonishing. And there's a lot of films that are referenced in there. So you've got Children of Men, in terms of this guy who's having to protect this child. Although in Children of Men, it's the mother of the child, and the child is going to potentially bring about the end of a war. You've got Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, because as you say, a lot of the film, most of the film, is set in Vietnam. Well, it's set in is set in Southeast Asia.
That's right. But it's clearly supposed to be a Vietnam analogue, because this was a film that really looked back to that imagery of Vietnam, particularly the war footage of Vietnam, in terms of the helicopters or the flying machines, as they are in this film, strafing the paddy fields, terrorising the villagers, going into villages and accusing them of collaborating with the enemy, bombing the temples, all that kind of stuff that the Americans did in Vietnam is in this film.
And it's simultaneously a Vietnam allegory and a 9/11 allegory.
Or like a post-9/11 world allegory, because it's all about terrorism and Nomad is just an extension of the Patriot Act and things like that. But it seemed weird to go back to Vietnam, though.
I'm going to say something controversial. I'm not saying that Gareth Edwards is pro 9/11, but he may have mixed feelings about that plane that hit the Pentagon.
I would say he doesn't have mixed feelings about that. I would say that he would say that was a terrible act. I think that he has problems, as I think a lot of us do, with the way that the West, particularly America, reacted after 9/11 and went to countries where it didn't understand the culture, where the people that it was terrorizing had nothing to do with this. I mean, weren't like most of the hijackers in 9/11 Saudis? They never invaded Saudi Arabia, did they? They invaded Iraq and then Afghanistan, or the other way around. And that unthinking bully boy foreign policy, I think, is what is being criticized here. It's just weird that it's using the visual language of the Vietnam War to do it. It seems too old now. But then again, I was thinking, well, does it seem... Are you using that because it would seem fresh to younger viewers who haven't seen any of the footage of Vietnam because they weren't alive in the 70s and 80s when Vietnam and the Vietnam War was really, really being dealt with by the Hollywood film industry?
Also, a lot of this film is just the Rogue One Star Wars movie that, that he was the director on, up until a point. It's just the beach scene from that. And
yeah,
we might need to have a very brief spoiler section in that because that's not the only DNA this film shares with Rogue One.
So let's have a very, very brief one then. Of Akira in this as well. But the thing that it most reminded me of, Elysium.
Elysium. That's, yes, I've literally got... This film does for AI and terrorism what Elysium does for space stations and socialised medicine.
It is fucking weird sometimes, Rob, the way that we inhabit each other's minds. That's pretty much what I walked out thinking.
Only this film is much longer and doesn't have Charlotte Copley.
It doesn't. Or Jodie Foster. Yeah, so Elysium was the Neil Blomkamp film with Matt Damon. And a film that, again, it looked great. It all looked great. The story on paper was good and interesting, but much like this film, the flaw of this film, why this film fails, is because there are no highs and lows in this film. It just goes along at a very, very flat emotional level. I mean, there's huge spectacle in this film, but there are no kind of set pieces. There's an attack on a village by these massive army tanks that are futuristic tanks. That is supposed to be a real sense of tension and dread, and then this big action scene. But the way that it's played and the way that Gareth Edwards positions the film, it's almost like it's a detached viewer. He just seems utterly detached from the emotion of it. I think because he doesn't want to portray it as exciting, because ultimately it is about an aggressor terrorizing an indigenous community. But you don't seem to care about it either. There's no emotion to this film. It just seems glazed. And I was watching it thinking, this is so weird because I am not involved in any of this and I don't think it's earning any emotional beat. But I don't think it's even trying to go for an emotional beat, apart from the very end, which ends on a high emotion. But it's like, how did we get there? I don't know how you think you've earned that ending.
Yeah, I found the ending up until a point actually quite moving, almost despite myself, because it's just like you're hitting this big red emotional button and it's kind of working, I think this is a fundamentally emotional scenario. I think the parallels between Neil Blomkamp's and Gareth Edwards' career are interesting because they both started, because, Blomkamp started with District 9, and Gareth Edwards started with Monsters by doing these indie sci-fi films that were praised for their visuals, despite being, on a quite a tight budget, that are set in a fictionalized version of a real life place that are using it as an allegory for a political point. And of course, and a film that I completely forgot existed till the moment I opened his Wikipedia page, Neil Blomkamp, of course, directed Chappie.
He did do Chappie, which is another AI film. I would say that Gareth Edwards, at this moment in time, is a better filmmaker than Neil Blomkamp because I think that Godzilla and Rogue One are better films. And even if you're just looking at Godzilla, I think that's just a better film than what Neil Blomkamp followed up District 9 with. Chappie was good fun. It actually wasn't terrible, and I thought it was going to be terrible, but it wasn't. But Neil Blomkamp also did Demonic, this huge action film that he made during lockdown, so he can't have more than four people in it. But he wants it still to be a huge action film about, I think they're alien invaders or something like that. Or like hell demons, anyway. It's one of those films where I was watching thinking, well, this film has to end with a massive, massive war between monsters and humanity. So how are you going to achieve that? Because you made all of this during lockdown, pretty much, or during those brief periods when lockdown was lifted. And what happens is the hero turns up at the end after it's all happened and gets told about it. It's like, you can't do that and get away with it. we want to see the action. We want to see the end of this film. Demonic is dreadful. So Gareth Edwards hasn't done anything as bad as that yet. I've not seen Gran Turismo either yet, but and I hear that's quite good fun, if utterly fictionalized from the true story that it's based on. But overall, I think, yeah, it's a pretty good comparison to make between the two of them. It was just a weird film, wasn't it? I mean, it was a film in which the only interest was in the production design and the cinematography and the special effects work, which were flawless. It was a flawlessly presented world. The amount of tiny details in there. So the production design and the background details were just absolutely fantastic. There's a very novel bomb in this film that I thought, it's interesting. Yeah, I've not seen that before. It's interesting. And in terms of the themes of this film, it's very interesting what they've done to that bomb to make it operate. But that's all just background. The story is the thing. The story here was just flat and pretty A to B to C. And the emotional arcs didn't work. I was quite surprised by just how uninvolved I was in it. I think that's me done on it. But sorry, I have talked a lot on this one. So what about you?
The film's not really about AI. Because in it, because the AI, even if they're inhabiting robot bodies, are so fundamentally human, even if, you know, the protagonist is forcing himself not to believe that, you know, when he kills one, he's like, oh, I'm just, you know, it's just off. It's not dead, it's off. But they're so obviously human that the film doesn't really have to grapple with the idea of AI. It's just, these are just people.
Absolutely, yeah. There are none of the complexities of the arguments around AI in this film. AI is presented as a good in this film because it is presented as just another form of humanity, an extension of humanity, or maybe even an evolution of that. In the real world, we know that there are real issues with AI and there are real concerns. That's a great point because that is a massive flaw.
This film is like Rambo 3 if we'd already known how things were going to work out with the Mujahideen.
It is.
Dedicated to the brave AI that's going to take everybody's jobs.
Well, there's a very good scene when there are lots of people working in a factory that are making the robots or the simulants, and they're all gossiping and just doing a job, and they could just be producing machine parts or anything on a production line. And again, it was like, well, you've created a believable world and you've populated it. There's a lot of people in this film. Well done.
Yeah, you built a world, you don't have a story within that I'm interested in.
Absolutely. And to your point, you've actually ignored something that I think is crucial if you're going to make a film about AI now. The genuine dangers of it.
Yeah. Shall we wrap up and then have a very quick spoiler section?
Yeah, cool. That sounds good.
Cool. So, Mr. Daniel, if our listeners are looking for you online, where can they find you?
Well, thank you for asking. If you want to find me on Twitter, you can't because I've come off Twitter. And I hear now that Elon Musk has taken away the tool to report misinformation. I mean, he is just a fucking scumbag.
And you're going to have to pay for it, so...
Hopefully so, because I think that will finally destroy Twitter. Because I don't think anyone's going to pay for it. But I think that he might roll back on that, because he knows that it will destroy. But hopefully he won't, and that it will just collapse as a platform. I have joined Blue Sky, but I can't remember what I'm logged in as, so I will have to tell you next time on that. But having said all that, the Movie Robcast is still on Twitter for the moment until I get around to taking it off. So you can find that at Movie Robcast on Twitter. It's also on Instagram at The Movie Robcast. And if you want to send us a film-related email, you can do that at movierobcast@gmail.com. As for myself, you can find my writing at electric-shadows.com, where I'm soon going to be writing about lots of amazing things at the London Film Festival, because as of recording, we're recording this on the 30th of September. That starts next Wednesday. And you can find me on Instagram at robdan75, and you can find me on Letterboxd to see what I've been watching at letterboxd.com/robdan. And also, we do another podcast, or we have another podcast that we've done, and it's there in all of its glory. And that's called Another Time MacLeod. And it's a scene-by-scene analysis with some amazing guests of that wonderful film, Highlander, which does have a full emotional arc and is very involving and will cause you to shed a tear in at least one scene. That can be found wherever you're listening to this. That is that still on Twitter, Rob?
No, I deactivated that.
Right, so that's been taken off of Twitter.
Just listen to that or send us a Highlander-themed email.
Yes, you can do, yeah. So just listen to that wherever you're listening to this. You don't need Twitter. And or you can send us a Highlander-themed email at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com.
Great. And yeah, if you're looking for me online, you can find my writing at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. I've actually been reasonably active recently and will hopefully continue to be with the London Film Festival. You can also find me on Letterboxd, which I've never said on this pod before, at letterboxd.com/Robert M. Wallace.
Hang on a sec. I didn't know this.
What? You didn't know I'm on Letterboxd?
No. Have you only just joined or have you been there all along?
I've been there all along.
Am I following you then? And I just forgot because you never post on it?
I think you are. Yeah, you're following me.
But you never post on it.
I've made my first post on there yesterday. I mean, I always add my films on there.
Do you?
Yeah, I just don't always give them a star rating or a comment. I've posted my first review on there, a couple of lines on the creator. It's my first review since Fantastic Four in 2015.
Right. Well, I will have a look at that. Do you add them to the diary, though?
No, I don't add them to the diary. That's a good point.
Add them to the diary because then they appear in people's feeds.
Right. You'll see my 2.5-star rating of the creator then.
Half stars. See, that's why I'm surprised that you haven't done it before, because you are one of those people that embraces the half star when I am. Nope. You can't go half. It's either this or this.
Yeah. If you do a half star, you're scoring it out of 10. It's not a 5-star.
Yes. And the creator, I would give 3 stars. One of them purely for the design of the film. Anyway, I interrupted, but I'm very, very excited that you are now using Letterboxd, because you've been watching a lot of films and I want to see what you've been watching.
Yeah, watching it in terms of, yeah, I think I'm up to something like 460 something films this year.
Yeah, which is quite a lot.
Yeah. I actually need to say, please, yeah, if you've enjoyed, thank you for listening. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please do rate and review. It's lovely to have the feedback and it does bump us up the algorithm that little bit.
Yes, indeed. That's a very, very good point. Okay, then. Well, shall we play a bit of the trailer from the creator and then get into spoilers?
Yes, let's.
Right, so you're going to hear the trailer. And then after that, if you haven't seen the film, don't listen. We're going to talk spoilers.
What do you want, sweetie?
For robots to be free.
Oh, we don't have that in the fridge. How about ice cream?
And you're now in the spoiler zone. I haven't really got any spoilers from this. Everything happened that I thought was going to happen. I just waited for it to happen. Including the whole Children of Men thing, that anyone who comes into contact with the kid that is a gestating fetus in Children of Men, of course, dies. To get the kid to the position where it can win the war or can end the war, everyone involved has to sacrifice themselves, even if they're not aware that they're having to do that. Because good and bad people die in this film. So it's like, yeah, I just get the feeling that John David as Joshua is not going to make it to the end credits of this film because this is Children of Men, right? But what was your spoiler?
Joshua, the name literally meaning God is deliverance. So...
yeah, it's like Unbreakable. Sam Jackson plays Elijah. And Elijah in the Bible foretold the coming of Christ. And of course, Elijah in Unbreakable knows that Bruce Willis is a superhuman. So I quite like that kind of thing that they'll play with names. Was that the only spoiler you'd got?
No. Okay. That's not the only. That's not the only. Is this the origins of the name Joshua?
Which of course then goes back to War Games.
Yeah, of course.
Because the computer in that's called Joshua.
You see, it all ties in. It's just that in terms of the protagonist, the creator has literally the same ending as Rogue One. Two lovers dying together, about to be killed. In Rogue One, it's because the bomb's going to go off. In this, it's because they're on the bridge of a crashing ship.
Yes, but both of them, even though one's on a planet and the other one is on a space station, they both end in a very, very kind of naturalistic setting or kind of elemental setting. So here it's like a field of growing crops, isn't it? And in Rogue One, it's on a beach. So the visual language of that is very, very similar. And the beat of it's very similar as well.
Yeah, I'd say, I think that might have been it. That might have been the only spoiler.
Yeah. Aye, aye, aye. It was a compendium of all of Gareth Edwards' favourite films, and let's hope that his next movie, ironically, has a bit of heart to it, because I thought this was not heartless, it just was absent of any real emotion. It just seemed to be going through the motions of telling a story. Surprised by that, to be honest, because I was quite looking forward to it. It's really interesting to hear that you pretty much have the same opinion. On that note... yeah, that was a mixed bag of films, wasn't it?
Yeah. Next time we'll be talking about London Film Festival.
Yes, I think we'll try and do what we normally do and kind of land 2 or 3 shorter episodes during the festival so we can keep you up to date on what we've been watching.
Well, again, thank you very much for listening and we'll be with you again very soon.
Indeed.
Somebody is dead. No one shall leave this place until I know who did it.
I didn't kill him. He was my mate. I will find out who did this. And when I do, I'm gonna bathe in their blood.